This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
You know, every year we're going to have a debate, and I volunteer myself to be debating real Hirose, as it itch to debate Dr. Hirose, but Nora Turow thinks that she has a better topic related to hepatitis C. So this is a debate that, so my plan got shut down. So this is a debate between really two great experts in hepatitis C about whether to treat or not to treat hepatitis C before liver transplantation with Jennifer Price and Dr. Turow, Nora Turow. And my only concern is that I worry that they may be too nice to each other during the debate. So before we move, let me introduce Dr. Price. Dr. Price, we recruited her from Johns Hopkins 4 years ago to partner with Nora Turow in viral hepatitis. They've done a lot of great things together, including this debate today. Jenny has been really wonderful to work with. In addition to viral hepatitis, she's done a lot of work related to HIV and liver disease, as well as fatty liver disease. And she's currently a recipient of ACG Career Development Award. So I don't know what they're talking about over there, but but maybe she wants to surprise me with something new. So the only thing I'm doing here is to, you know, which slide do you want to start first?
It's all in one.
It's all in one. Okay. And that's the other folder. Okay. And folder two. Okay, thank you. And that's Price. Okay. All right. Oh. Okay.
We're going to try doing the mics here. Let's see if this will work so we can move around a little bit more. So judging from that picture, we decided that we shouldn't both be standing. We thought that would look bad. So we are delighted to bring this debate to you. Jenny and I have worked on this kind of together. It's a little bit different format to the usual debate, but not too far off. We still are going to disagree, trust me. I'm going to set the stage. So it's a difficult kind of topic to cover because we all know that the spectrum of patients on the waiting list is very, very broad. On the one extreme, we've got the patient who's got Child's A cirrhosis, doesn't have any manifestation of decomposition, and their only indication for transplant is HCC. And then we go through the spectrum to that mildly to moderately decompensated patient who may or may not have HCC, has mild to moderate portal hypertensive complications, may have some degree of synthetic dysfunction. And then at the far end, the advanced decompensated cirrhotic may not necessarily have a high MEL score, but has refractory symptoms or severe symptoms of portal hypertension and moderate to severe liver synthetic function. And when we think about treating these patients, that also represents a spectrum in the sense that the patient on the left has many direct antiviral options, a very high chance of SVR, which we'll touch on, and then we're going to go through kind of the harms versus benefits. And then as you move across the board, again, the more advanced cirrhotic, less DAA options, a modest reduction in our SVR rates, and then we start to get in again some of the challenges in assessing risk versus harm. So because it's a spectrum of patients, we felt that sort of one, the best way to really discuss and have this debate was to do it as a patient-based scenario. So we're going to start with case number one, which is a 61-year-old man with HCV and HCC, blood type A, genotype 3, treatment experienced, and DAA negative. Naive. On diuretics for lower extremity edema, lactulose for what was previously known by someone to be an elevated ammonia. His MEL score is 14, Child's Pugh score is 8, based on the labs that you see there. And he has HCC with a 2.3 centimeter segment 8 lesion and a 2.8 centimeter segment 6 lesion. He's been TACE 4 times and had a PERC injection of alcohol for twice and still has residual enhancement and washout in a segment 8 lesion. And so before we start our debate, we're going to do an audience poll. So based on that scenario, how many would treat this patient with DAA therapy? Okay. You're making it difficult. No, let's give a MELD score of 28. Okay? All right. How many people would treat this patient? Oh, I'm going to have so much work to do. Okay, how many would not treat the patient? You have to vote. Okay? Okay, great. All right. So I'm going to take the yes on this one. So I'm going to argue that this patient should be treated with DAA therapy, and I'm going to provide sort of the rationale for this is that we have a very high chance of cure. It's important to keep this patient's liver function stable as he goes through local regional therapy. He's a Child's Pugh B. We don't want him to slip into being a C, maybe, and not be eligible to get more local regional therapy. I hope to prevent worsening decompensation on the list, keep him stable to transplant, and of course, if I treat him pre-transplant, I will eliminate the risk of HCV post-transplant. So just to remind us of the success of therapy and even a Child's Pugh B patient. So there is a small decrease in the SVR rates when you move from a Child's Pugh A to a B, but it's a very modest decrease, so I would argue that it's still a very successful therapy. And shown here are the results across the board in terms of therapies using soft lidiposphere, soft VEL, elvisphere grasopivir, that would be for Child's A only, and then, of course, Viekira, PROD regimen, which would be also for Child's A. But the regimens that we use in patients who have Child's B are soft-based regimens, and you can see that our success is not, it would be 86 to 94% in this patient who has Child's B cirrhosis. And just to point out, he's a Child's Pugh C. He's a genotype 3, and so this patient does have some decrement in response. What I just showed you is genotype 1 disease. And we all know that if we're going to treat this group of patients, we'd have to use ribavirin, and as shown in the bars on the bottom, even with a genotype 3 patient, I can get an SVR rate of 85% if I was to use a ribavirin-based therapy. So genotype 3, known to be more difficult to treat, that might have entered into your decision-making here. He's a Child's Pugh B, but this study, I think, gives us good evidence that this patient would do very well with treatment. It's not 100%, but 85% chance that he'd be successfully treated. And the other important aspect is that I can make him better by treating him, and this is data looking at soft lidiposphere and looking at improvements in Child's Pugh score. So you can see that looking 24 weeks after cure, that's more than the vast majority of patients will have had an improvement in their MELD score, her Child's Pugh score, and in some cases that improvement in Child's Pugh score could be as much as 6 points. And in this study, if you took patients that had Child's Pugh class C, you saw that up to 76% of the patients had an improvement in their MELD score, and in the Child's Pugh B, it was 40%. So I'm probably going to make the patient better. Better from the point of view of being able to tolerate their local regional therapy, better that they're going to survive to get to transplant. And I'll remind you that, you know, we have high rates of dropout. So this patient has a long way to go. I think Mary Pat's question about what's the MELD score was kind of being, was really pointed at how long do I have to wait before the patient's going to get there. This is our data at UCSF. And just to remind us that patients with HCC wait a long time. This patient's got sort of bad biology, I think we would all agree, and so we're going to have to worry about managing this HCC over this period of time. And I would argue that you also are managing his disease. So when we look at the rate of dropout in these studies, it's a reflection both of HCC and of progressive liver disease. And this patient has Child's Pugh disease, and although his MELD score is only 14, he also is at risk for progressing liver disease between now and when he actually gets a transplant. So for all those reasons, I've got a good therapy. I can likely treat him and successfully. He's going to improve his CPT score, and that may allow him then to get his local regional therapy and successfully get to transplantation. So for all those reasons, the patient should be treated.
Wrong. Just kidding. So don't worry, I'm not gonna call Nora names or threaten to imprison her or anything. But I am going to argue the case against treating this patient. So you may know some of these points already. I think this is a good example of a patient who, just because we actually can cure them, it might not actually be the best thing for this individual person. So we really have to weigh sort of the pros and the cons. And in here, I think the cons outweigh the pros. First of all, I'll show you some data that it's actually going to be easy to treat him post-transplant, so we don't have to really worry about complications with treatment after transplant. Probably most importantly, there's some emerging data suggesting that actually DAA treatment may have a negative impact on HCC recurrence. And then finally, as Nora pointed out, this patient has really bad tumor biology, and he's not going to die of his hep C. What he's at risk of dying of is his HCC. So he really needs all options for liver transplant available, including a hep C-positive donor organ. So just briefly to talk about treatment. This has gotten a lot easier now in the post-transplant setting. Now that we have the newer all-oral regimens, we have a simple regimen that doesn't have many drug-drug interactions that we can use with our immunosuppressants post-transplant, and that we have really high cure rates post-transplant. This is a study of 162 liver transplant recipients who received lidipasvir sofosbuvir post-transplant for 12 or 24 weeks for the most part, with or without ribavirin. And it's not a head-to-head study compared to pre-transplant patients, but what you can see here is the really high SVR rates. I don't know if the pointer. There you go. So overall, 94 to 98%. So the SVR rates in the post-transplant setting is really what we've come to expect pre-transplant. I think a more compelling reason to hold off on treatment in this patient is that there's actually some emerging data that suggests that there may be a risk, an elevated risk of HCC recurrence after initial successful treatment in DAA-treated patients. And I know when the all-oral regimens first became available, many of us, myself included, were really eager to treat these patients. We didn't know if curing their hep C would decrease the chance of HCC recurrence while they were awaiting transplant, but we didn't think it was going to harm them. There was no suggestion from the interferon era that curing the hep C would increase the risk of HCC. And now there's been some literature suggesting that that assumption may not have been appropriate. And the two big studies that recently came out were these studies from Italy and Spain. And they both looked at groups of patients with hep C cirrhosis and HCC who had their HCC treated by a variety of methods, resection or local regional therapy, who were determined to have complete tumor response. So they had no residual disease, no evidence of recurrence. And then their hep C was subsequently treated a median of a year after their HCC was treated, and they were observed. And what both the Italian group and the Spanish group noted was that they actually had a surprisingly high rate of HCC recurrence in a really short period after their DAA treatment. So the Italian group found that 29% of their cohort had HCC recurrence within the first 6 months after DAA therapy, and that the Spanish group found, similarly, 28% had HCC recurrence, and that was a median of 3.5 months after DAA therapy. So these studies got a lot of attention and gave a lot of people pause. I think it's important to note here that both of these studies were retrospective studies, and neither of them have comparator arms. So these are relatively high recurrence rates, but they're not compared to people who were otherwise similar that weren't treated. And in fact, there was a study that came out from France around the same time that looked at 79 patients with hep C cirrhosis and HCC, 13 of whom underwent DAA treatment, and that group did not see any difference in HCC recurrence in those who received treatment versus those who didn't. And that was prospective. It included DAA non-treated patients, although the numbers are fairly small in terms of treatment. So I think the bottom line is whether DAA curative therapy increases the risk of HCC recurrence is still a controversial issue, and I think we're going to see more data emerging, other centers presenting their experiences, which hopefully will kind of shed more light into this. But in the meantime, while we're still trying to figure this out, I think we have to be really cautious about who we're treating, who's going to get transplanted anyway. And certainly somebody like this with bad tumor biology, if there isn't a really compelling need to cure his hepatitis C, may be better off waiting. And then finally, the other reason to wait and hold off on treatment is because, as Nora mentioned, he has a very, very high risk of waitlist drop-off. So here in our region, he would have over 25% chance of dropping off of the waitlist. And although it could be because of decompensation and just getting overall more ill, it's more likely that that's going to happen because his HCC, it just falls, takes him out of criteria with his waiting. So what he really needs more than anything else to save his life is to get a liver transplant. So I think in this sort of patient, we have to maximize all of our options for transplant, talk with him about living donor, talk with him about all high-risk donors, and that would include hep C positive donors. And this is an analysis by Jen Lai that's in press right now, where she looked at the relative availability of hep C positive donor livers in the United States. The dark blue bars here are the proportion of the deceased donor pool that's hep C positive. So nationally, that's about 4% of the donor pool that's hep C positive. And the light blue bars are the proportion of hep C recipients who received a hep C positive organ. So the amount that different centers rely on these hep C positive organs varies regionally, but this is a very good option in terms of decreasing wait time for somebody like this patient. And this is something that I would certainly encourage him to accept. So that's my case. I don't know if you want to rebuttal.
Of course,
I do. Because I have to win over a few votes here. So just keep in mind, the data shown on the HCC, of course, yes, we're all concerned, but it is uncontrolled, and these were previously patients that we never really treated. So the argument has been that actually in the past, these are patients we would not have treated, and we're sort of observing a natural history now that is something we weren't observing before. In the past, these patients just would have died, actually, most of them. And now we're sort of treating more advanced liver disease, more decompensated disease. We're going to see more HCC because we're actually having people that are going to survive longer, going to get to the point we're going to treat them. So while, yes, we should be cautious, it's one of those things that I think, you know, bear in mind that if we opt not to treat this guy and he gets to the point where he's not eligible to take his local regional therapy, then he's going to die in, you know, with his HCC and potentially would have had an opportunity to be treated and have gotten to transplant. And the HCV positive donors, so the only thing I'm going to say about that is that actually I think that's such a temporary problem, because truthfully, you know, there are now studies that are underway. We're doing one at UCSF where you give patients who are HCV negative an HCV positive donor. So this is kind of a temporary problem. So this idea of holding out for the HCV positive donor for me is like a poor reason not to treat someone who I otherwise think needs to be treated. Because if I really want to, I'll treat them again afterwards if they happen to be lucky enough to get that 5% chance that they're going to get. That's a very small number of donors here in Region 5. So if they're lucky enough to get that organ, great, I'll treat them again. But to hold back all of the HCV patients on the list from being treated for that is a very concerning kind of tactic.
Although we are not doing wrong.
Okay, let's do the summary.
Okay, all right. Sorry. So
now that's the... Yeah. No questions. No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. No, we want to do a vote first. One more vote. I want to see if I got anybody to come to my side. Anybody in favor? Yay! All right. Well, we know the rest of you all know. So it's okay. All right. Are there any questions? Actually, Rio, feel free.
Thank you.
Do you want to respond? I'm happy to, you know, feel free to. Point taken. But I think that this idea that, yeah, there's kind of, oh, repeat the question. So Rayo's point is, at the moment, there are more patients, sort of, there are lots of donors that are HCV positive. The a lot is kind of, I think, a very, I hear this very often, and that there's sort of nobody on the list who can take an HCV positive, but, you know, that the magnitude of that, I think, is a little less certain to me. But point taken, I do think it's very temporary. There already are studies that are underway, and I think it's really a very temporary problem. And I think we will very soon move towards the fact that a Hep C positive organ could go to anyone. We're going to know how to treat that and manage that. And so I see it as temporary. But I think your point is well taken. Today, there's probably an advantage.
So, yeah, so the question is a good question. So why would the DAA treatment increase the risk of HCC recurrence? And the answer is it's all theoretical right now. What's been postulated is that the immune system is sort of keeping the tumor at bay or in check while their HCC was treated. And when you give them the DAA therapy and they have this rapid reduction in their viral load, they also have a rapid reduction in their chronic inflammation and sort of a change in the inflammatory milieu that sort of alters this immunosuppression of the tumor. So it's a little, you see me doing a lot of this.
I just take note of that, okay? No, I'm just kidding.
That's sort of the theory of why this could potentially be happening. We do see other sort of immunological unexpected sort of complications of DAA treatment, like the Hep B reactivation, for example. So it's sort of along those lines.
I have a question for both of you. Perhaps, you know, say whether you have HCC or no HCC, there may be a subgroup you would like to treat to prevent transplant or to avoid liver transplant.
Oh, we have another case. Oh. All right, well, that's okay. Thank you. For the
sorry, we'll try to move quickly.
Okay, we just have one more case. We had three before, but we figured it would take too long. Okay, so I'm going to start with this one. This is a 58-year-old man with Hep C and alcoholic cirrhosis, blood group O, genotype 1A, treatment naive. He has small varices on EGD but hasn't bled. He does have a history of mild hepatic encephalopathy, which is stable on lactulose, and his primary symptom has been refractory ascites, requiring intermittent paracentesis on a monthly basis. He's also had two prior hospitalizations with AKI in the setting of excess diuresis. His MELD score is 20, and he's a child PUC. His score is 11 based on these labs. So before we tell our sides, how many of you would treat this patient? There's like a regional distribution to the responses.
Okay, no.
The no's are in the center.
No's are in the center.
He's been sober, so he's listed for transplant. Okay, so I'm again the no. So my argument to not treat him is, first of all, that we're less likely to cure him. And if he relapses, he's likely to end up with DAA resistance, which would make him more difficult to treat post-transplant. There are also fewer treatment options, just in general, because he's decompensated, and then we're really in trouble if he develops renal failure while on treatment. And finally, the likelihood of him ending up in this MELD purgatory is higher because he's already fairly decompensated. So briefly on treatment, you already heard from Nora that we can treat decompensated patients, but their treatment response is lower compared to compensated cirrhotics or non-cirrhotics. So this is a study that looked at lidipasvir sofosbuvir with ribavirin for 12 or 24 weeks. And you can see here that the SVR rates are lower in the child PUB patients, and then they're the lowest in the child C patients, so 81% in the child C patients. And then it also just highlight here that the child C patients had the highest rate of death. Actually, 9 patients died on treatment, 10% of the patients treated, which perhaps speaks to the severity of their underlying liver disease. And similarly, this study now with sofosbuvir, declatisfer, and ribavirin in decompensated patients shows that the SVR rates are influenced by the severity of the liver decompensation. So basically, any of these indices of advanced liver disease that you're looking at, ascites, encephalopathy, low albumin, all of them are associated with lower SVR. So what about the safety? So we can't use protease inhibitors in patients with decompensated cirrhosis, so that leaves you with sofosbuvir and the NS5A inhibitors. Sofosbuvir is renally cleared, so if his GFR falls less than 30, then you're kind of stuck. So you have to be cautious of that, and if you need to treat him for 24 weeks, that could be an issue. But overall, the safety of the DAAs, of the sofosbuvir and NS5A inhibitors, does appear to be relatively well tolerated in these patients. The issue is these are very sick patients, and so serious adverse events are common in this group of patients. So this is a study of over 400 patients who were decompensated and who were treated, and a quarter of them developed a serious adverse event. Most of them, serious adverse events related to liver disease, so like ascites, infections, you know, encephalopathy. But how much the medication may be contributing is really not clear. So overall, the DAAs appear to be safe. Relatively low discontinuation rates. It was about 9% in that last slide. The ribavirin-associated anemia is common, and it's more problematic to manage, but we also know that ribavirin is an important component to treatment when you have decompensated cirrhosis. But as I mentioned, the other adverse events are consistent really with the clinical sequelae of advanced liver disease. And it's difficult to determine if the DAA is an increased risk because most studies are uncontrolled. So there's a few controlled studies that suggest that the adverse events are predicted by the severity of liver disease and not the treatment per se, but it's really hard to know whether or not the treatment was involved. And there was one study recently published that followed people before they were treated and then during treatment and found that 14% of patients with advanced disease who were treated developed a lactic acidosis during therapy, while there was no episodes of lactic acidosis prior to therapy. So it could be that the medications are the culprit of some of these decompensation events we observe on treatment, and we're just not actually recognizing it. But even if we are able to cure this patient and get him through treatment without a serious adverse event, the question is how much meaningful clinical response we're actually going to give him. And I think at some point we have to recognize that we've kind of crossed that point of no return. So he's very decompensated. His bilirubin 6.7, his albumin's 2.8, he has refractory ascites, he's getting paracentesis on a monthly basis, he has encephalopathy. What's the likelihood that we're really going to make a meaningful improvement in his survival if we are able to treat him? Cure him. And I'll point to this study was over 100 patients who were listed with decompensated cirrhosis, or hep C cirrhosis, who were treated with DAAs, and they were listed, and then they were followed out. They were all cured, and they were followed to see if they were inactivated and delisted. And the point that I'll highlight here is that the MELD pretreatment predicted the likelihood of being delisted or inactivated because they became too healthy. So the patients that started with a baseline MELD less than 16, almost half of them were delisted or inactivated in a median follow-up of 52 weeks. But in the patients who are closer to what our patient is, so patients over 20, there was only a 15% chance that they would actually get off the list. So the concern here is that, as Nora showed, the synthetic function they might have a biochemical response, so the MELD score may improve with SVR, but the concern is that they're not going to improve enough to avoid liver transplant. And in fact, that improvement in the MELD score may make accessing a liver transplant even more difficult, particularly if we are able to cure him and then he can't take one of those hep C positive donors until we're giving them to people who've been cured. So this idea of, you know, we're preventing worsening decompensation, but then kind of condemning them to being sick but not sick enough for a prolonged period is this concept of MELD purgatory, that we might not actually be doing the patient a service. So your turn.
All right. Okay, so I'm always arguing the yes here. So here we go. So the reason to treat this patient is really data I've already shown you in part, and I'll reiterate a little bit more, and that is the majority of the patients you treat are going to get better. They're going to get better in some way. Whether they get better enough or not, we can have that discussion, but they're going to improve the majority if you give them sufficient time, 12 weeks, 24 weeks after SVR. They will have a decrease in their MELD, and they'll have a decrease in their CPT class. And I think that this idea of having the potential to avoid transplant is a very real and important one. We've heard all day today about the challenges that we have in terms of getting enough organs for our patients. So if we can identify and treat patients that are good candidates for potentially coming off the list, that's a good thing. And I'm going to say in the end that the other kind of challenge, very specific to regions like ours, is that if you don't treat this patient and you say, well, we're just going to let their MELD keep going until they get to transplant, is the reality is that they could probably die before they get there. So again, just more data. I've already showed you CPT scores. This is MEL scores now, just showing the improvements that you see. These are, you know, plots just to show that the majority of patients are going to receive, are going to improve. And you get more improvement the sicker you are. Not too surprising about that. But see that the MEL change in MEL scores in many patients was more than 5 points. And so it just kind of speaks to the fact that we can get very meaningful changes when we actually achieve cure in these patients. But for me, the compelling data is to try to get them off the list. And so this is data from France in which they actually had a very strict definition of what was a response when they did AA therapy. They characterized, they were all patients that were Childs A through C. They had some HCC patients in here as well, although this data is not including the HCC patients. These are just cirrhotics. And they defined after DAA a complete response being somebody whose total bilirubin was less than 2, INR less than 1.2, albumin less than, sorry, that should be greater than 3.5, no ascites, no hepatic encephalopathy. That's a Child's Pugh A patient. That was just, and that's a patient they felt had demonstrated a complete response. That's somebody you would, I think, agree should be taken off the list or inactivated. And in this study, 1/3 of their patients actually achieved a complete response with treatment. And it was more likely, of course, in somebody who started out as a Child's Pugh A, 72% of those patients, but 25% of patients who were Child's Pugh A, so 1 out of every 4, improved to the point that they could potentially be inactivated on the list. And you've seen the slide, so now I'm going to do sort of a little bit more of the emphasis on the delisting. So Jenny already showed you really the likelihood of response. So this patient did have a MEL score of 20, so sort of sitting right around that range where, you know, maybe the chance of success is maybe somewhere between 5 and 18% in this particular study. But here again, we see that that's the proportion of patients that can be delisted. So that's a very strong marker of a substantial improvement in the patient's symptomatology as well as their overall clinical and biochemical status. And then I'll remind you that when we don't treat, you're kind of, it's a bit of Russian roulette, because you then have to have the confidence that you're going to be able to get the patient to transplant without treatment. And we all know that, you know, this risk for mortality on the wait list is certainly not trivial. If we take a patient who's got a MEL score that gets into the 27 to 28 range who doesn't have cancer, you know, we're talking about somewhere around 25% mortality. This is just within periods of 3 months. And you saw slides earlier today from John Roberts where he's showing you that the vast majority of our patients at UCSF are getting transplanted over 30. So you have to have a lot of confidence that when you opt not to treat a patient and potentially, you know, get them off the list, there's this other flip side that you're going to let them be untreated and they're going to die before they get to transplant. And so my sort of strongest argument for doing treatment of patients like this is that really the ability for us to be able to get them to transplant, I think we have to acknowledge that a higher proportion than 1 out of 4, which are going to get improvement, many more are going to be at risk for dying before they get to transplant. So my argument has always been that MEL purgatory is better than dying. All right, so we're going to do a final vote, and then Jenny and I'll take a final few questions. So again, so this is the summary that Jenny presented the no and I presented the yes. All those in favor of treating this patient? Yes, okay. I had to get one. All right, very good. Any final questions before we step off the podium? Steve.
There's a lot of suppositions here.
For sure. I'll let you take the first question. Well, no, it's appropriate.
Oh, yeah, I think the first question is important. I think that at some point patients are just so sick that it's very difficult to get them through treatment and to have a meaningful response. I think if this person wasn't a transplant patient, then you would, I mean, you don't really have anything to lose, right? So except for maybe possibly side effect from the medication. It's the fact when they're a transplant patient that it makes it a little bit harder to decide, you know, if you could get the Hep C positive organ, maybe you can shorten the wait list time. I think you can go really either way in somebody like this, and that's why we picked the MELD of 20, which is sort of the borderline. But there are patients that I think they're in the hospital a lot, they are getting AKI a lot, and I just don't know that you're doing a service by giving them this medicine. You might just be better off waiting until they decompensate further and then transplant them and then treat them after. Yeah.
I mean, I think you're high. So the question is really, you know, why aren't we treating every decompensated patient? We've got the drugs and you know, really, is there harm? And I think that we picked this case to show that this is actually it's not an easy decision, actually, and it does need to be individualized. And I think one of the challenges is the sicker they get, the more they are likely to have renal dysfunction, and then we really don't have good treatment options. I mean, we still have gaps in our therapies in terms of good combos to use. So, you know, as we're dealing with the higher MELD scores, as Jenny was pointing out, then it gets actually harder to treat, a little less safe if you're using ribavirin, et cetera. So it has to be individualized for sure.
Other thing, when they are so decompensated, then they have these additional episodes of decompensation, it's really tricky to know, was it the medication, was it not? And it becomes really challenging to decide, well, do I stop treatment now? I mean, there's a really high chance that they're going to get hospitalized. Their bilirubin's going to go up. Was it the sofosbuvir, or wasn't it? So that's part of the equation as well.
Last question.
Yeah, the question was, would your decision be different if you're in a different region?
Meaning somewhere where they can transplant in the 20s?
I mean, I think if, you know, the concern with treating them is that their MELD score is going to kind of stabilize and not get too high, but there is a chance that they'll improve and not need transplant, and, you know, if you have transplant as a backup in case they don't improve, that would favor, in my opinion, treating them. We often, if a patient has a living donor or potential living donor, we're kind of more likely to try treating them just to see if there's reversibility. And if there isn't, then they can get the living donor transplant.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.